We'll start with some questions. Could you discuss the fourth misperception of Subha in What is Asubha? So first I'll give some context for this. There's a sutta in which the Buddha describes four kinds of misperceptions, each of which happens at three levels. This list is called the Vipalasa. And the four are basically misperceptions around taking what is impermanent to be taking what's impermanent to be permanent, taking what is unreliable to be reliable, taking what is not self to be self, and taking what is unbeautiful to be beautiful. This is the one the question is asked about. Asubha means unbeautiful. So the misperception of what beautiful and what is unbeautiful. We've talked a lot about the first three, recognizing that we tend to take things that are impermanent to be permanent, unreliable to be reliable, not self to be self. And the three levels I'll just mention since I mentioned it. The first level is a misperception, kind of just like making a perceptual mistake about something. So for instance, the analogy in the suttas around this is if you walk into a room or a place, walk into some place and you see a coiled form in the corner, you might initially misperceive it as a snake. But then on a second look, you might take it to be a rope. It might be a rope. And so it's been misperceived at first. And the teachings, the commentaries mention that this first level of misperception is pretty easy to correct. Just a little bit more information and you'll see, oh, that was a misperception. The second level of misperception is thinking. We perceive something incorrectly and then we think about it and it gets a little bit stronger. You know, we think it's that. It's not just the split-second perception. It's like, you know, you might leave the room and say, there's a snake in there. The third level, which is the most tenacious, is the distortion, we could say, the distortion around view, where the view that something is permanent, reliable, self, is so strong that even evidence to the contrary can't convince you otherwise. So, you know, really hard to kind of come over those. So those are the three levels, and it's like each one gets stronger and stronger, essentially. And so the three that we've mostly talked about are the three that are associated with what are often called the three characteristics or the three perceptions, three of the perceptions that are useful to cultivate. So this fourth one is included, the perception of what is beautiful and what is unbeautiful. That is a mistake that our minds tend to make. So my understanding of what this teaching is pointing to that we tend to, like, primarily my understanding is that it's around our bodies. A teaching in the Satipatthana Sutta describes the Asubha practice the practice of contemplating the unbeautiful, and the encouragement is to look at the body as if it were a bunch of parts. Head hairs, body hairs, skin, nails, teeth. I've heard an instruction about this, to contemplate this, you know, like as if you're sitting with a bunch of plates in front of you and think about, okay, this is part of the body, this pile of head hairs, okay, that. Is that beautiful? Is the pile of nails beautiful? Is the pile of skin beautiful? So it's just beginning to kind of point to the reason, the way we take something to be beautiful, and particularly bodies, has to do, at least my understanding, you know, it has to do more with an idea, a concept of what the whole thing is or something, and so not really seeing it's just composed of parts, and if you look at the individual parts, it's not so beautiful, perhaps. Joseph has a story about this, and he told this in a Dharma talk, so I feel okay saying this. He said he had a colonoscopy at one point, and he got to watch. He was awake enough to watch, you know, the video, and it's like he saw that, and it's like, is that me? You know, is that beautiful? I don't think so. You know, kind of looking at the inside of the body that way. And then he reflected, you know, when he, you know, thinks about, you know, all of those parts inside the body, you know, the intestines and the stomach and the heart and everything. And then you just wrap it all up in skin, and it's like, yeah, that's beautiful. So it's the teaching is, I think, about correcting or pointing to the way in which we typically have kind of a desire for the human body. So I think it's pointing to that understanding that we're attributing beauty perhaps to something that is, when looked at from a different perspective, so again, this is about perception, when looked at from a different perspective, can be seen as not so desirable, not so beautiful. So the question goes on, I think I see a lot of asubha, I think I see a lot of the unbeautiful, and I'm confused what makes it liberating. Makes me think I need to turn away from pleasure in the material world. So I think sometimes what's going on, potentially, I mean, without having more of a conversation here, it's a little hard to unpack, but if we're orienting to things and attributing, you know, not beautiful to them, or the word asubha is sometimes also translated as foulness. I don't particularly like that translation because that does create a sense of, in that word, in the West at least, it feels like it creates a sense of aversion to the body. And I don't believe that's what the intention is, because the Buddha encourages us to let go of aversion. But I think he's encouraging us to let go of the way in which we misperceive, we misattribute. We get attached to something out of a misperception, a misunderstanding. We're not really seeing it clearly. But the there can be a tendency in some of our minds, to kind of orient towards what is not pleasurable, not beautiful. And that may be, I mean, in terms of the, you know, I think I see a lot of asubha. So, you know, I would, in certain contexts, I would ask a little bit more about what are you seeing as unbeautiful? What are you seeing as asubha? What is that experience? Because it is possible, partly because what the question is saying, it makes me think I need to turn away from pleasure, from the material world. There's a way, I think partly this teaching is kind of, again, it's pointing to this in-between place, our usual relationship to body, you know, sense experience is to go for the pleasurable side of it. And we think that letting go of craving for that means that we need to push it away, hate it. But the teaching is about noticing that it's conditioned, noticing that it's arising and passing, noticing that it's impermanent, that it's not worth craving, it's not worth clinging to, because suffering will follow. So it's not so much about turning away from the material world as it is understanding the material world for what it is. And that, at times, it's a skillful means to consciously recognize or turn away from our usual relationships, our usual clinging to, our usual holding on to things in the material world. Paradoxically, it feels somewhat paradoxical in this practice that when we let go of craving and clinging, when we are available to notice just what's happening in the present moment, sometimes the sensory world can be astoundingly beautiful. Not so much because we're attributing beauty to a thing, but because there's the just the seeing of it. And it's like something about the quality of the seeing and the just the awesomeness of the whole process that creates this sense of awe and a sense perhaps of beauty in the mind. You might be walking down the street if you're, you know, especially on retreat, you know, you'll walk down the street and you see some like candy wrapper on the ground. And it's like, wow, look at that. That is so amazing. The shape, the color. No, not the object itself, but the quality of the mind, the quality of the attention can create that feeling of beauty. Appreciation. So I think the teaching on noticing what is, noticing that we tend to take what is unbeautiful to be beautiful is a pointing to the way we tend to. It feels like to me like it's a little bit of a reinforcement to the unreliable teaching. You know, we tend to take what is unreliable to be reliable. We tend to take what's not suffering to be. I mean, what's suffering to be? I take what's not suffering to be suffering. No, the other way. We tend to take what is suffering to be not suffering. It's a little bit more of a pointer to notice in particular around the body, around, you know, the way in which we attribute beauty to the body. And it's liberating because it begins to correct our familiar and usual ways of relating to bodies, of relating to what we think is reliable, what we think is pleasurable. There's another teaching the Buddha uses around pleasure, sense pleasure. I like this teaching. This one feels a little more accessible to me. The Asubha teaching can feel a little inaccessible. And in fact, there is a teaching in the stories of the Buddha of, you know, the Buddha actually taught a whole bunch of people the Asubha practice. You know, the contemplation of the body is unbeautiful. Before he went into retreat, he gave them the teaching, and while he was on retreat, the story goes, half of the people committed suicide. And he came out of his retreat and he said to Ananda, "Gee, the assembly looks empty. What's happened?" And Ananda said, "Well, half of them committed suicide." And he said, "Don't you think it might be useful to teach them mindfulness of breathing?" Kind of a pointing to, you know, maybe this practice isn't for everybody. I also actually love this story because it points out the humanness of the Buddha. You know, that story made it into the suttas, I think, is kind of interesting. So I think the practice is not for everyone. And then the other teaching that kind of is more accessible around sense pleasure and orienting, learning to orient differently around sense pleasure, is a three-part teaching called Gratification, Danger, and Escape. And it said, you know, first of all, when there's sense pleasure, he acknowledges, yes, there's gratification with that. There's a form of happiness that comes with getting what we like, sense pleasure in the body, you know. Even in this case, it feels broader than you know, sensual pleasure. It could be any kind of sense pleasure. Sense pleasure of eating, a sense pleasure of seeing beautiful art or anything, you know. So he says, yes, there is a gratification that comes with that. Notice the gratification that comes with it. Get familiar with that experience of gratification. So he's kind of asking us to start where we are there. We do have a sense of satisfaction with sense pleasure. So notice the gratification. And then he says, notice how far that gratification extends. Essentially, how long does it last? How satisfying is it really? How gratifying is it really? So again, the next step here is like, so this is what we do. This to me feels, again, really in line with the way Sayadaw Tejaniya teaches. It's like, just notice what's here. It feels good to get what I want. Okay, that's good. You notice that. You notice the feeling good. You notice the feeling good. You notice the feeling not so good. You feel, when was the last time I felt good? Is when I got something. So let me go looking for something to want. So we start to see that the gratification that comes with sense pleasure is pretty unreliable. And he says, that is the danger in the sense pleasure, that the gratification that comes with it, that what we put on it, it's not giving the mind, it's not giving us what we really are looking for. And so that's the danger. And we begin to understand the danger of sense pleasure our mind begins to recognize, not worth clinging to. The danger is in the clinging. It's not in the sense, it's not in the sense object itself. It's in the relationship to it. And so we begin to understand that the clinging, the holding on to it, is, you know, how the suffering is created. And so the mind begins to let go of that, begins to not pick it up, begins to understand that, yeah, picking it up is just going to give me a few moments of sense pleasure. It's like, is this worth it? Maybe sometimes. And so that orientation to being curious about how far the gratification extends begins to help the mind to understand how impermanent and unreliable it is. And then when we see the kind of the craving around it disappear, we may feel a different kind of gratification. Now this has been kind of a surprise and interesting for me to observe wanting, you know, observe wanting. Feel the craving, feel the pull, feel that sense of, you know, needing to have something. And just being with the wanting, seeing it go away, seeing the wanting vanish, feels so like being released from a vice grip. It's just, whew, wow, relief, release. That's a different kind of gratification, a different kind. It's a gratification that doesn't depend on having or holding. It's a gratification with letting go. And that, he says, is the escape, the release from the craving. So to me, that's a little bit more accessible teaching on subha, on pleasure, and how to navigate it. But with the question of, I think I see a lot of asubha, you know, that makes me wonder if the mind is essentially orienting towards things that are unpleasant, unbeautiful, out of habit, a mind that is oriented towards, has a habit of aversion, tends to look for things to be averse to. It's like, it's not just receiving things in a nice, simple, like, you know, our minds don't just receive things just in a simple way, like we're video recorders and microphones taking in every single sight and sound. We are more selective than that. And our habits, in particular, if you have a habit towards aversion, when you look at something that you've never seen before, your mind may tend to orient towards what is unpleasant or what you don't like about it. That was what I discovered about my own mind, this very aversive mind, that when I let the mind relax and just like kind of say, okay, what's the most obvious thing? It was always something unpleasant. Maybe different for a mind that has a kind of an orientation towards greed. That mind tends to orient towards what it might find satisfying or pleasurable. Very different experiences. And so I wonder with this question if there's a little bit of that habit of, you know, an underlying habit of how you're looking at the world that tends to orient towards asubha. That's not based in wisdom, but is based in conditioning, based in delusion. So it might be worth just kind of being curious about what's happening with the experience of something unbeautiful. You know, is there Yep. What's the relationship there? I do think that this teaching around asubha is probably more useful for those people who tend to have the greed mindset. In fact, in the Visuddhimagga, you know, it says it, that's where this, like, they talk about three different, or six, I think, actually, different kind of minds, and, you know, roughly based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And what's useful meditation quarters, you know, situations for them. And for people who have a tendency towards greed, they get really simple environment. Not much, you know, not much around. And for someone who's aversive, it's like, give them really comfortable place to practice. So, you know, just a kind of a, maybe a little bit of an investigation around what, when you say, I think I see a lot of asubha, but what are you seeing? What are you seeing? Is there aversion in the seeing? Is there a pulling away already in the seeing? Asubha is not about aversion. So this is a longer note question. I think I read it a while to see if I could summarize it. I think it's just easier to read it. Following this path has felt like sliding down a steep hillside, and below dwells awaits a cliff. When I first slipped and started tumbling downward, perhaps it would have been easy to catch myself and find a different path. For a while now, though, it's felt like the cliff is approaching and time is running out to stop my fall. The momentum is getting too strong to move in any other direction. I can see from here that once I'm over the cliff, all illusion of control may be lost and life may be fundamentally different. It's exhilarating. It's terrifying. How do I practice with this? And how do I make choices from here? Now, there's two different things that come to my mind in reading this, two different things that this could be connected to. And one is, you know, the momentum of the practice at a certain point. Yeah, we start to see things that we don't necessarily think we're going to see when we walk into this path. You know, the word on the street about meditation is that it makes everything better. And mindful eating, mindful painting, mindful walking, mindful relationship, mindful work, and you'll be happy. And, you know, what this practice, what the practice the Buddha offers us is a practice of really your mind's 101. I said that the other day in a group. You know, this is what we get to see. We get to see what our minds are doing, and it's not so pretty. You know, it's painful to see it. And we do start to see, you know, kind of the really slippery nature of what we were holding on to. That sense of homesickness that I talked about yesterday, not being able to go back. At a certain point, so many delusions are shattered, there's no way to go back to, Yeah, I could just pack that all up and put it aside and pretend I don't know how much suffering my mind causes me and just like go on with my life. It doesn't work with after a certain point. You know, wisdom has us. And so there is a way that we, you know, have to keep going. We don't have much choice. And what I would say in terms of the practice with this is notice a relationship. Notice the exhilaration. Notice that it's terrifying. Notice wanting to stop, wanting to not fall down that cliff. Noticing the fear. Notice that. Because that's where the system is going. You know, the system, the underlying parts of the system are going, you know, no, it shouldn't be this way. That's partly how I take this question, you know, the kind of the seeing of, can I turn back? You know, can I unsee what I've seen? We can't. And so there are some relationships there. This is very much in the terrain of the disenchantment that we talked about the other day. So notice how you are in relationship to this. Another piece of this is, you know, kind of in a similar place or similar flavor, potentially, is, you know, just seeing how, you know, the illusion of control, seeing that, you know, wanting the control, the illusion of control broken partly through just seeing the conditionality, seeing how rapidly things change, seeing nothing is being done by a choice by I'm making, it's just happening. And so again, the same instruction of notice the relationship to this. Things happening very rapidly. What's the relationship? Noticing the uncontrollability. What's the relationship to that feeling of uncontrollability? And making choices. Sometimes wisdom will make the choices for us. Sometimes we'll feel like, yeah, I want to stop doing this. I want to stop practicing. And, you know, sometimes we can do that, but certain places in practice, you know, at one point the Sayadaw, I was reporting something, and the Sayadaw said, the good thing to do in this time is to stop practicing. I thought that was very odd, you know, that he would say that, but then I just said, you know, Sayadaw, I can't stop practicing. And he said, yep, that's right. But if I had said, yes, I can stop practicing, I don't think he would have stopped me. You know, if I could have packed up and gone home, you know, maybe that would have been the right choice. So, you know, wisdom participates in these decisions. This is not an easy path. This path to releasing suffering. There's so much wanting it to be otherwise. Wanting there to be something that we can grab hold of and crawl out off the cliff. You know, some idea that would be good. You could try that for a while and then you'll find out, my guess is, given, you know, how deeply you are on the path, you know, that You'll find out that's just a delusion. It's just a delusion that I can even crawl out, crawl up the slope. And then choices. This came up in a couple of the groups, and it feels at a different level than this question, but it feels worth saying, especially since we're heading into the world, more into the world, more into our familiar lives. So sometimes when we're faced with making decisions, and this happened to me at one point, I was seeing, you know, this would be a good way to go. I've got a choice here. I can go this way, or I can go this way. And I could feel that both choices were, there was wisdom in both choices. There wasn't a feeling of one choice being a denial of anything and another choice being a holding on. It was nothing like that. It was like, this choice, yeah, that would be a good way to explore things. This choice, that would be a good way to explore things. And I didn't know how to make the decision. I felt a little stuck. And so I asked Gil, how do I make this decision? And he said, do you know what you want? And that just burst through. It's like I kind of had some idea that I'm not allowed to kind of take into consideration my, you know, my history, my conditioning, and where my aspirations are, where my kind of, you know, natural draws are. There was a way he intuited, I think, that I was kind of, you know, artificially blocking off what, you know, what direction, you know, where's the heart headed? And then it was instantly obvious to me. I knew which direction I wanted to go. And sometimes we may not have that clarity. James Perez tells a similar story of a time in his life where he had this, like, you know, choices in different directions. And he went to his teacher and asked him a similar kind of question that I asked Gil. And his teacher said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter which choice you take. You know, that's, they're both skillful. Flip a coin. Pick one. And then notice the relationship to not having chosen one. That's where a lot of the issue is, I think. You know, we feel like there's got to be a right choice, and what am I missing out on? A lot of the fear of missing out if I don't choose something. So that's where the clinging is, not in the choice itself. And so just look at the relationship to choice and make a skillful one. And if there's multiple skillful choices, just pick one. And notice what happens. Notice the conditions that follow on from there. Just live your life. Live your life.